Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com. My home is not on this
earth, not in this world. Some preachers should come with like a public health warning at the beginning. This one needs one of those. Right, let's hit the ground running. This is going to be fun for me, less for you. And we're going to carry on with Mark. And we're going to start looking at Mark by going to Leviticus, first of all. Let's read Leviticus 15. If you've got your Bibles, you can follow. We're going to jump through a few and then we're going to settle in Mark. And it will stretch us a bit, and that is a good thing. Okay, Leviticus 15, starting verse 19, says, "When a woman has a discharge, and the discharge in her body is blood, she shall be in her menstrual impurity for 7 days." Welcome to Christchurch Manchester. I hope you're all feeling comfortable and happy this morning. "And whoever touches her shall be unclean until the evening. And everything on which she lies during her menstrual impurity shall be unclean. Everything also on which she sits shall be unclean. And whoever touches her bed shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. And whoever touches anything on which she sits shall wash his clothes and bath himself in water and be unclean until the evening, whether it is the bed or anything on which she sits. When he touches it, he shall be unclean until the evening. And if any man lies with her, and her menstrual impurity comes upon him, he shall be unclean 7 days, and every bed on which he lies shall be unclean." Jump forward to verse 31, because there's only so much of that you can read. It says, "Thus you shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst." Okay, so this is from Leviticus, which is a piece of literature which is 3,000 years old, written for and by a community of people that lived in the deserts, and this is instruction from God to them. And really, it's hard for us Westerners perhaps to understand this idea of cleanness and impurity. Perhaps we need to look at India and the caste system maybe to get an idea of what that might be like, but maybe in our part of the world, There isn't a direct equivalence. And really what is described here is someone, a woman, being cut off from society, cut off from human relationship, not even being able to touch or be touched. Imagine that if you are a mother and this you have this and you're not allowed to touch your own kids or touch family members or friends, and slowly you are put out onto the edge of society. You're also cut off from the temple, or the tabernacle as they call it then, but would become the temple. So in many ways you are separate from God. You can't go to God, you can't go and see the priest, you can't atone for sin, anything like that. You are cut off for however long the bleeding lasted, whether that's just 5 days, whether that's weeks, whether that's months, whether that's years. Okay, so let's move. We're going to move now to Numbers 15. If you want to, you can turn there. 15:37-41 will be appearing behind me as well. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Speak to the people of Israel and tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a cord of blue on the tassel of each corner. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, to do them, not to follow after your own heart and your own eyes, which are inclined to whore after. So you shall remember and do all my commandments and be holy to your gods. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your gods. I am the Lord your God." Okay, so slight change of scene here, but there's some instruction again from God to Moses about putting tassels on garments. You know, I think, God, what on earth? But it's for them, it's like a prayer shawl, a cloak, and they were putting these tassels on to help them to remember some things. So this prayer shawl, this cloak, would have been worn by teachers, people, maybe scribes, or people who were wise and who went round and taught taught people, it is very, very likely that Jesus wore one of these. He was referred to as teacher. Jesus was as Jewish as the next person who lived in Israel at that time. And so it is very likely that he wore a shawl like this. And so these tassels are a visual reminder that God is their God, that he bought them out of Egypt. He bought them out of slavery, of oppression, of deep suffering. He bought them out to be his people. He made them his people. They didn't make themselves his people. He made them his people. And then he set them apart to be very different from the other peoples of the world. He set them apart to be holy. He set them apart to be pure, not to be unclean. And it was a great reminder that God himself is holy. Also a reminder of his promises. You see those tassels and you think, yeah, God brought us out of Egypt and then he gave us a way to live, a way to follow him. Okay, so these prayer shawls would have been common and seen and understood. Let me jump forward again to Malachi 4. Okay, go to Malachi 4, just a couple of verses here. It says, "For behold, the day is coming, burning like an oven, when all the arrogance and all evildoers will be stubble. The day that is coming shall set them ablaze, says the Lord of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings, and you shall go out leaping like calves from the stall." So this is prophecy about the coming of the Lord. It's prophecy about the return of God. It's a picture for us to make us understand something. And that something is the Messiah. So this idea of the Son of Righteousness, it's Son, S-U-N, but it's this, this thing that rises up and beams something at the world. It is a hint of the coming Messiah, the Saviour of Israel. And then it talks about this Son of Righteousness shall have healing in its wings. And wings is the same word as corner. Okay, so remember the corner of the prayer shawl with tassels on it, it's the exact same word. So they were putting these two things together. And so he's saying that the corner of the prayer shawl, the wings, there is power there. There is power in this garment. And so legend kind of grew between Malachi being written and the New Testament times, was a few hundred years. Legend grew that when the Messiah would return, and they were expecting the Messiah, the people of Israel in the exile that they were in at the time, and they were in Babylon and then were slowly coming back into Jerusalem and into Israel, but they sensed in themselves that they were still a people in exile, and they were waiting for their king to return, their Messiah, their Savior, to lead them and take them back into freedom. Like Moses took them out of Egypt, this new Messiah was going to come and bring them out of slavery. And this Messiah was something they powerful that they almost couldn't quite describe properly. And he was so powerful, even his prayer shawl, even the corner of it with tassels on, that itself had power in it. So we're now ready for the Gospel of Mark. Let's read Mark 5. 21-43. It says, "And when Jesus had crossed again to the boats to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, 'My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay hands on her so that she may be well and live.' And he went with them, and a great crowd followed him and thronged about him." Jesus at this point was being followed by probably thousands of people. So we're not talking about just a few people who are getting in the way. This is logistically very, very difficult. It's packed in. There are people everywhere. They have heard about this guy who's doing crazy miracles. And so, as would happen, thousands of people are packing around him. And it says there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. Okay, let's pause for a second there. Okay, suddenly you're understanding why we've read Leviticus. Is anybody else hearing feedback while I'm talking? Is it just me? ringing in my ears. I do have an amount of tinnitus, so it'll probably be that. Let's refer back to where I was. Right, so there were, so yes, so we'll pause there. Now, there were, at the time, doctors. So it says she went to see doctors. There wasn't much difference between a doctor and a magician. Okay, this is where she was at. Her healing, or their ways of healing, were obnoxious, were terrifying. I read and heard a little bit about some of the ways that they thought that they could heal women, particularly who had this issue of bleeding, and it was deeply unpleasant. So when it says that it made her worse, well, we can understand. She hadn't stayed as she was. They hadn't just not solved it. They had made her worse. She had suffered from this disease, suffered because of the doctors, suffered because of the physical pain that she was in, suffered also from the social exclusion that we know she was experiencing, because we've read about that in Leviticus, and the people of Israel would still have understood that. And she would have suffered, as we know, the sense of separation from God. You're unclean. You can't go in the temple. You can't approach God. She was suffering. And so we've also read about this guy Jairus and his little girl, who is at the point of death at this moment in the story. And there is not much difference, really, between where this woman is and where that little girl is. In many ways, this woman's life is close to death. She has no friends to speak of, because she can't get near them and touch them. No family. If you sat on a seat that she sat on, you become unclean, so nobody wants to go anywhere with you. She is very distant, and could be described as nearly as dead as the little girl. But she is in the huge crowds. And remember what we said, thousands of people, very densely packed. By her being there, she's going to be surrounded, and she is being touched by people, and she is touching people. Remember Leviticus 15. Now, there are lots of people there that are being made unclean, as they would understand it. And it was a very dangerous situation for her. Actually, if people had found out what was going on, I dread to think what would have happened to her. She had put her life on the line, as you do when you are desperate. And then it goes on, verse 27. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garments. For she said, if I even touch his garment, I will be made well. Okay. So this idea of what we've read in Malachi, that the Son of Righteousness, even his clothes have power. Even this prayer shawl that he would be wearing, even that somehow is powerful. And we don't know what her theological understanding was. We don't know how deeply she thought about this. But Mark wants us to see, look, this is who this is, this Jesus person. He is this Son of Righteousness. He is the coming of the Lord. This is an important moment in the history of the entire universe. So she reaches out, she touches. And verse 29 says, and immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. So the word disease is a very similar word to torture. Okay, this is what she was healed of. She had been tortured by this. She had been relieved of an affliction, a very profound physical affliction, which she had been physically healed. She felt it in her body. She was healed in that moment. It's not like she went home, tested out a knee joint, a couple of days later, think maybe it's better. In that moment, she was healed. But also, you think about what went through her head, knowing everything that we now know. In that moment, she's physically healed. She'd think, I'm not unclean anymore. I can be touched. Other people can touch me. I can reach out and touch people. Actually, this now means I can go into the temple of gods. Perhaps she think, oh, maybe now I can be married. And, you know, 21st century Western places say, well, she's a strong single woman. She doesn't need to get married. Actually, one of the few ways that you could have economic security and build any sort of life for yourself was by building family, by having kids that would work for you and work with you, and you would build up some economic security. So she has gone from really having no sense of any future or purpose or vocation to suddenly it's all changed for her. Imagine what went through her head in that moment. I'm healed. I'm free. This is incredible. But Jesus, actually, that wasn't quite enough for him. Verse 30. Jesus
perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said, so you can imagine it, looking over thousands of people going, "What are you talking about? You can see the crowd around you, and yet you said, 'Who touched me?' And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell before him, told the whole truth. And he said to her, 'Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed.'" I think we get an incredible lesson about Jesus there, because he asks a question, and he asks a question because he doesn't know something, which sometimes you can think of Jesus as this all-knowing thing that just kind of floats through the Gospels and nothing affects him. He's largely unbothered, knows everything that's going on all the time. Actually, what we get here is a picture of him saying, "Well, who touched me? What happened there? There's a lot of people here. Who touched me?" There's a hint of his humanity. And he doesn't know the person, but he wants to know the person, which is very important. He wants to know who reached out. And it isn't just, "Oh, I need to know just to tick off a box," actually. Jesus isn't content with a simple transaction. Okay, so power left him, someone has been healed. But for him, he's like, "I'm not an impersonal dispenser of healing. I don't just walk through a crowd with my powerful shawl of healing. You can touch me, and then we all just get on with our lives. You get healed, and that's it." Actually, he has no interest in that. No interest in being a God who does or doesn't answer prayer. So we ask God for stuff. He either says yes, no, and that's the end of it. Actually, what does he want in this situation? Well, he wants to know who. He wants to know who touched. I want to know the person. Who is this? What happens? How can we know each other? And so she tells him her story. And he listens. And actually, even as we read that, we see that she came forward. He doesn't turn and point and go, "It was you." She came forward and, knowing what had happened, being terrified because she would have to announce, "Okay, I've been unclean for 12 years. I have just pushed through this big crowd of people. And there's a reasonable chance some of you are now unclean because you touched me. Sorry about that. Don't stone me." But so that would have been a genuine thing. She comes through terrified. Is she fearful of Jesus because of what he's done? Quite probably. Is she scared of what might happen to her? I would say almost certainly. But she pushes through, tells her story. And what does Jesus say? Well, actually, he just tells her who she is. Here's her story. He says, "Daughter." First thing he says, identity. That's who you are. "Daughter, welcome to the family. You're in. Well done. You're part of us now. You are welcomed in. You are unclean. You are in the people of God." The things she'd never been able to do, go into the temple for 12 years because she'd been unclean, to relate to God, to know him, to make offerings and sacrifice to him, to be atoned for. She'd not been able to do any of that. And Jesus just says, "Daughter, in you come." And she gets there by her belief and his power. He says, "Your faith has made you well." Well done, your faith. You've stepped out, you pushed through the crowds, and you're now part of my family, part of my people. And then he tells her to go in peace, which is just a great line. You can say, "Oh, it's just chill out and off you go, you're fine." Actually, no, there's much more to it. Go in peace. Peace is a whole life event. It's a picture of being socially in a good place, physically in a good place, even economically in a good place, and spiritually in a good place. Peace, as they understood it, was a whole life healing. And he says, "Go, live out your whole life healing. Your life is changed now." This is a big picture of what it is to follow Jesus, of how he changes our lives. Actually, the peace of God covers and changes everything. And she is restored as well. She's now in God's people. Like we talked about, she's now able to come into the temple. And the temple is no longer the physical bricks and mortar of the temple in Jerusalem. Actually, it's the people of God. We talked a bit about that last week. She is restored physically, spiritually. She's restored in her purpose and meaning in life. And while all of this incredible stuff was happening, poor Jairus has just stood there watching. Imagine what was going through his mind at that moment. Verse 35, "While he," Jesus, "was speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." Same word as what the woman who'd been bleeding, that's what Jesus has said to her, "Your faith has made you well." It's the same word as believing. He's saying, "Do not fear, do what that lady just did." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James and John, the brother of James. And they came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. And Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping, wailing loudly. Incidentally, at that time, you could hire people in for your funeral to make a big noise. It was a thing to do, actually, to get a kind of professional group of mourners there to make a big racket for you, which, as jobs go, can't be a great one. And he said, and when he entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. So for this guy, his little girl is gone. So we are left with a broken father, really. The dream is dead, effectively. He's gone to Jesus with something that he wants to happen, very much like the lady who was bleeding. And now it's done. She's gone. She's dead. And the crowds laughing is a picture of human logic there, isn't it? Totally limited, totally constrained to what it can see, to what it can understand in its tiny mind. Human logic laughs. There is no understanding that actually death is a thing to be defeated. This Messiah, who even the corner of his cloak is powerful, actually gets to come and defeat death. This man Jesus will finish it off. He is the Son of Righteousness from Malachi. He brings healing. He restores. We who are broken and dying will go leaping like calves. That's how Malachi described it. And brings us back to life. And Jesus knows how to deal with cynics and those who mock and those who laugh and the foolishness of human logic. He knows how to deal with that. It says he put them all outside, took the child's father and mother. And you just think, oh gosh, I hope I'm not one of the ones that gets put outside for not understanding, for mocking, for cynicism, for my totally restricted faith and worldview, which just looks at the problem and thinks, oh, it's done. There's nothing I can do about this. So therefore, it cannot be solved. And Jesus put them outside, took child's father and mother and those who were with him, and went in where the child was. And taking her by the hand, he said, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, rise," which is a term of affection, really. It'd be like with your kids saying, "A beautiful girl," or if it's my girls, "cheeky monkey," or something like that. It's a wonderful term of endearment that he's saying. And he's loving this girl. And immediately the girl got up and began walking. And then Mark says, because she was 12, which I just think is really funny. Think about it. The scene of tension there, the parents, disciples all watching, and she's healed, and the first thing she does up is get up and walk around. You think, why? Well, because she's 12. Can you strap down a 12-year-old? No, you can't. Those kids, they just want to get up and walk around. She gets up and is wandering around, and they're immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charges them that no one should know of this, because if you remember, there are thousands of people. This thing is chaos. It could go south very quickly. Jesus actually knows what he has to do. He knows he has to work his way to Jerusalem to suffer and die. So he's saying, look, just don't tell anyone. This needs to happen in the right time, in the right way. Oh, by the way, get something to eat as well. She's hungry. Okay, so there you want to understand a picture of Jesus. He knows that he's got to go and die. He knows what his journey is. He also knows a 12-year-old girl is going to be hungry, because being raised from the dead is hungry work. And so he sorts these things out. It's a brilliant story. And what can we pick out of this just before we finish? Jesus wants to know you. So there's a picture here of a warm, open, inviting. He wants to know this lady who really, she is way outside. And he wants to show this little girl some affection. And actually, we see two people affected here. They're like Jairus, who's at the top of society. He runs a synagogue. Lots of influence, lots of good reputation, well thought of. He is clean, shall we say. And then we see this woman, the bottom of society, outside, not well thought of, unclean, untouchable. You can't even sit on the seat that she has sat on. You know, that's the picture that Mark speaks to. He says, actually, it doesn't matter where you are, how influential you are, how powerful you may feel in your own life. Actually, you still need to come to Jesus. You're not just a face in the crowd. And God wants us to know as well, actually, he didn't send a dispenser of medicine or a slot machine of wish fulfillments. He actually sent his son who wants to know us, wants to relate to us. He wants to know and be known. That's very important. When he turns around and says, who touched me? It's actually, I want to know your story. I want to know what happens. I want to see the peace that I bring worked out in your life. I want us to be friends. So he wants to know you. And regardless of your approach, he wants to know you. So verse 27, we see this lady. She hears Jesus. She moves towards him. She reaches out to him. Did she want relationship with God? Was she thinking, yeah, I'm going to have a series of really good quiet times. I'm going to build that discipline in my life. I'm going to work hard on the quiet time thing. And I think then maybe God will sort me out. That's how it's going to work. No, she's desperate and just grabbing for what she thinks is going to work. She's going after a cloak that she can touch that's powerful, for goodness sake. She's not thinking clearly. And did Jesus actually stop her and say, hey, wait a minute, how are the quiet times going before we get to the healing bit first? How is your life of self-discipline as a Christian? Tell me about your discipleship. Tell me about all the good things you've done. He doesn't even know he healed her. She touches him. She is healed. He did it without even realizing it. And this little girl, you think about how do we approach God? She's dead. That's how she approached God. Someone else had to do it for her. Jesus went to her. So he wants to know you, regardless of how you approach, the competence or otherwise of it, he wants to know you. Regardless as well of how long it takes, he wants to know you. There is a real sense of time in this story, isn't there? Real sense of how God works things through. And unfortunately, it's not in a 21st century Western sense of time, which I find upsetting. In my family, if you arrive 5 minutes after you said you were going to arrive, you're late and we look down on you. That's how it works. If you don't turn up when you say you're going to, I'm like, okay, 5 minutes. These people are of low character. That's what they are. That's how late. This is how it's going to work. When we were in the Ukraine, they were explaining to me that if you get there within a few hours of when you say you're going to get there, that's fine. And I was feeling a bit self-righteous about this. And then you see one of their cars and you realise they break down a lot. Therefore, that explains it. So their sense of time is somewhat different. But God has no problem with waiting. Absolutely no problem with a father whose daughter is dying being forced to wait. Think about what's urgent and important there. He is quite happy for the father to wait and the daughter to die, for the dream to die, actually. He's more concerned, I think, with his glory being shown, with his kingdom being moved forward, perhaps with our character developing and us learning to trust him more than he is concerned with getting the events done in the right order and in a pace that would suit us. So Jesus closed the divide between us and God. This divide of uncleanliness actually is a picture really of sin, of the way that it taints us and damages us and puts us outside. Puts us outside the people of God, puts us outside of even being able to get to God and relate to him. Puts us in a place that is a long way from peace, a place of torture. She was described of her disease and suffering. And we can go and find different places. Maybe we go and look at, talk to doctors. Or perhaps we give our lives to living in other ways. Perhaps in the pursuit of money or pleasure. Or just in being comfortable and things not hurting too much. Actually, perhaps we go after those things instead. But actually, it doesn't remove the uncleanliness. And Jesus brings that restoration to us. And he cleans us. In the Psalms, it talks about how we're lifted out of mud and mire. And put on rock. That's what Jesus does. And also, he deals with death, which is hard for us because we don't understand it, and which is probably how it should be. He undoes death. He finishes it. Death doesn't have power anymore. Jesus removed that power. In that moment, we see it. Her death, as the woman who bled, was social as well as her physical pain and in her relationship with God. But the child's death was, she died. I mean, she was dead. Physically dead. And yet Jesus deals with that. Brings her back. In fact, to him, it's really so not a problem. He says, oh, she's just sleeping. It's fine. It's not a problem. And he deals with our identity as well. We go from unclean, we go from dead, to daughter or son. That's quite a thing, isn't it? First thing Jesus says is daughter. Oh, this is who you are, this is your name now. This is who you are, daughter. And to the girl he says, oh, little girl. Someone, I am very affectionate for, you're my little girl, you're in my family. He changes who we are.